Well, good morning. It's Jeff Wine, host of The Car Show here on Sun Sounds Radio. Folks, once again, we have an action-packed show for you today. Going to catch you up on the latest and greatest of the world of the automobile. Well, I'm actually in Alabama right now, in suburban Birmingham, watching the Alabama Grand Prix. The IndyCars are running down in Alabama, and I am on the second leg of a big trip. I saw NASCAR last weekend, and now this weekend, I'm attending the IndyCar race at Barber Motorsports Park. So we'll catch you up on what's happening down there. We'll also find out what's happening with some of the other things going on in the automotive world. We'll catch you up on what's going on with some IndyCar news with some IndyCar rides with Indianapolis 500 coming up next month already. Can you believe it? Of course, we'll talk about what's going on with gas prices, some weird and unusual automotive news, and of course, it wouldn't be the car show without a little car talk. You know what to do. Fasten those seatbelts nice and tight. It's going to be a fast ride on the car show. Let's talk about the location of where this race is today, and it's the Barber Motorsports Park is an 880-acre multi-purpose racing facility located on the eastern fringes of Birmingham, Alabama. It was built by George Barber, including the Barber Vintage Motorsports Museum, which has been named the world's largest motorcycle museum by the Guinness World Book of Records. The museum is a 501c3 not-for-profit foundation. It's considered the largest philanthropic project ever taken on by an individual in the history of Alabama. Now, the park, which opened in 2003, has a 17-turn, 2.38-mile road course designed by Alan Wilson and viewable from severally naturally wooded or grass-covered banks. The track is designed to run clockwise. The layout is compact with a number of elevation changes. The pit lane is to the outside of the track, parallel to the front stretch, and the pit wall is on the driver's left. There are two cutoff turns, which are barricaded when not in use, which allows the track to be shortened for club events or testing sessions. An entryway between turns 9 and 8 access the museum garages, and a tunnel underneath turn 12 allows emergency vehicle and maintenance vehicles to access the infield. Now, the track is unusual in having no general access spectator seating at the start and finish line. The area outside the front stretch, which is bounded by the track on three sides, is occupied by a multi-level paddock building. The building along the front stretch between the start and finish and turn one houses the media center, race control, track offices, garages, and some VIP viewing areas. The main spectator area is along the back stretch between turns 8 and 11, and spectators can watch from embankments or temporary grandstands erected for race weekends. From this area, most of the course, except for turns 2 and 3 and turn 13, are visible. A food and souvenir vendor area is located behind the grandstands in the vicinity of turns 9 and 10, and additional spectator areas are available between turns 2 and 3 and turn 14. There is generally no spectator access to the infield, and an RV park and camping area is located at the top of the hill behind the paddock. Now, a little pause there. One of the things that's happening with this trip as well is my good friend Michael Schutz and I camped at Talladega last weekend, and we are camping this weekend at Barber Motorsports Park. So it should be a lovely time in that situation. Now, the track hosts numerous motorsports races, including Grand Am, Pirelli World Challenge, Vintage Racing, AMA Superbike, and the IndyCar Series. It serves as home to the North American Porsche Driving School, along with various track day events. It will also be part of the new Barber Proving Grounds, which includes a new track area with wet and dry skid pads that will accommodate events while the existing track is in use. For example, Mercedes-Benz hosts the Mercedes brand immersion experience for its employees at the Proving Grounds, and other uses of the grounds test and demonstrate vehicles' capabilities, host product debuts, safety instruction, and Barber is noted for its landscape and greenery. The track has often been referred to as the Augusta National of motorsports. So really looking forward to checking out this race this weekend. And I'll have some results for you and some more download about how the trip has gone when we talk about road trips. This is an epic one, 1,700 miles just to Birmingham from Phoenix. And then in between the two racing series, I am visiting and have visited family in Florida and in Georgia. So it's been quite the trip. I'll have more information about that when I come home. But let's get on with the car show. And from the pages of Hemming Motor News, This one's called Rolling Repairs, and this is by Terry Shea. Is it possible for cars to fix themselves? Well, my friend Paul has a Eurospec 1982 Porsche 928S 300 horsepower machine designed for consuming lots of miles at high speed for extended periods of time. Where Paul lives, well, he has the opportunity to let it loose and put the hammer down when highways are empty. Now, for a GT car designer on the Autobahn, the 928 eats up miles with little complaint. On a recent trip, he tells me, the car just settled in on the highway and the speed just kept on going up and up and up. I know for a fact there are no radar guns between my house and the redacted location, so I just let it rip. There was a huge stretch of the highway where I was above 200 kilometers per hour, which is approximately 120 miles an hour here, for at least a half an hour. Some of it even winds through the mountains. This car still can boogie. While this Porsche eats up the miles, and boogieing aside, it's still a 42-year-old car, complete with its issues. Now, if they don't affect the safety of the operation of the vehicle, Paul will tolerate those little nuances that, until he gets around fixing them. In the case of the 928, the air conditioning and the speedometer and the dashboard lights are all kind of fickle, only operating intermittently. Now, those items were on the list to be sorted out, but since he's recently been driving the 928 a lot, those intermittent problems have magically gone away. He swears that old cars fix themselves. The more they get driven, the more they fix their problems. Now, he's quick to point out that new cars will never do this. The cue is he tripped to the mechanic for that clunking noise that certainly goes away the minute you drive into the repair shop. Now, Paul also bought a Volvo P1800, sight unseen, for restoration, and I'm pretty sure there's a hole in the block where a piston and a connecting rod punched out an immediate exit. And I don't think that's going to fix itself. Otherwise, Paul may be onto something. Now, we've all heard of the Italian tune-up, where the advice is to take the car out on the highway and mash the throttle through the gears, supposedly to clean the carbon out. Now, the idea is to bring the engine up to speed and build up temperature to remove the carbon deposits that can form on internal components as a result of combustion and the air-fuel mixture. Now, there is some research. That talks about the high temperatures, and they will begin to break down those carbon deposits. Few hard pulls to the red line through the gears might not be enough to bring the car up to sustained temperatures for this process to really work. I can only guess that the 928 engine is as clean as a whistle at this point in time. However, modern cars with turbochargers and gasoline direct injection that also notoriously suffer from carbon buildup in the intake valves get no such release in a process like this. Now, the 928's problems all seem to be electric related. Certainly, there must be a loose wire, or three. I know exactly the scenario he speaks of. I owned a 1988 BMW M3, a fun car that requires the engine RPM above, about 4,500 RPM before any of the fun got started. I also had those random electrical faults where driving for a certain amount of time at certain temperatures, let's say the speedometer and the odometer and the trip computer and the radio and the AC would temporarily quit. The tach is still working, so I knew how fast I was going. When it would get hot in the summer, fortunately the BMW's magical S14 engine sounded needing a replacement and needed some of those tunes on the go. If I continued to drive, all those functions would magically return. No blown fuses, no obvious broken wires, no loose connections. That random old car stuff never really affected the drivability or the safety of the M3, and it never occurred to me that there was a shop for one of those many oil leaks that afflicted the car. Absolutely never once did I fix those leaks, or did they fix themselves? The problem with a modern car is you have the throttle by wire and brake by wire, and such weird things as door software that not only regulates the window and lock functions, but works in conjunction with many other systems. If one goes down, then they possibly all could go down. There's still countless possibilities for loose wires, but I'm fairly certain that the software has never been healed by a 120 mile an hour blast thrashing down the highway. And I would believe that. I think that's a good analogy. Well, I certainly have a pension right now for possibly moving from my Mustang to a Corvette. So I've been reading a lot of Corvette articles lately and talking to my friends who are Corvette enthusiasts. And the title of this article is the 1963 Chevrolet Corvette Stingray Z06. This rare, race-prepped coupe is the most valuable street-legal first-year Stingray available. Now, due to changing external forces at General Motors, they had a fickle relationship with factory-backed racing in the 50s and 60s. And the corporation ostensibly keeping motorsports at an arm's length when the second-generation Corvette arrived, and it was also nearing this racing debut. Didn't stop the engineers from the Chevrolet Sports Car Group from designing and building specialty parts for the new Stingray that would establish a dominance in competition. The regular production option code was Z06, selected for 199 examples and surviving examples of a limited production run that are coveted by most classic car and Corvette collectors. Regardless of the official GM policy on racing, Corvette team had long been actively encouraged in motorsports, and the glory that brought this model, Chevrolet, a whole lot more. No privateers who wanted to compete in their 1962 Roadsters would specify the RPO 687 to gain the heavy-duty suspensions, braking components, as well as a quick ratio steering and a 37-gallon fuel tank. Ticking the RPO 582 brought in a 360 horsepower 327 V8 topped with a Rochester mechanical fuel injection. Versions of these special upgrades would have a place for the new 1963 Stingray about the time they bundled everything under the RPO Z06. That's the special performance equipment. Now, selecting this, a racing hopeful would have to lay out, not insubstantially, $1,818. That's about $18,000 in today's money, on top of $4,000 for the car itself. And then if you want that fuel-injected V8, you're going to have to throw down about another $430. Four-speed transmission, $188. Positraction limited slip differential, $43. And later that year, Chevrolet lowered the Z06 package to that time for $1,293. Now, it's always been one of those things, especially in the mid-2000s when the retail book came out with classic car values. ClassicCar.com has been tracking the value of many variants of Chevy sports cars over the past 5 years. And a non-Z06-equipped 1963 car now sells on average for about $160,000 at auction. The Z06 variant is in a special case. The benchmark is $500,000 for those cars. And one of the most expensive coupes sold for $1.2 million at Amelia Island and the Concours and the Gooding Company auction. So these figures could certainly outstrip what currently we're seeing on some of those prices, about $250,000 to $500,000. So the Z06 Camaro, which basically means this is the super performer car of Corvettes, not Camaros, Corvettes, and it certainly is a valuable car, and this is the 63 split window. I'm certainly looking for something a little more modern as I try to decide what I want when it comes to a Corvette. So, we'll see. Got a long time to go, and I'm not in any big hurry. Going to do my homework, look around, and see what kind of good deal I can find. Well, before you know it, it'll be the month of May, and I'll be heading to Indianapolis for the running of the Indy 500. And the headline reads, Daily to run at Indy with Polkadot backing on a groundbreaking community-supported deal. Well, Connor Daly will carry the branding and the colors of Polkadot for the number 24 Dreyer Reinbold Cusick Racing Chevrolet he'll pilot for this year's running of the Indianapolis 500. Now, according to the company, this sponsorship represents the first time that a major athletic sponsorship has been decided by a community vote using blockchain technology. The proposal to sponsor Daly passed by an overwhelming 95.8% approval, demonstrating the community's eagerness to show the blockchain technology and its real-world applications. Daly is going to be entering into his 11th Indy 500 and his first with the Indy 500 specialists at Dreyer Reinbold Racing. Quote, the fact that thousands of individuals in the Polkadot community, not a corporate marketing team, use their voices to vote and select me as their ambassador is an incredible honor and reflective of the power of what more and open internet can look like in the future, Daly said. The fact is, I'm not just racing for a brand or a logo, but I'm representing developers, investors, and regular people who are building tomorrow's web. It's thrilling and overwhelming, and we're bringing power back to the people by making sports history. So Connor Daly lost his ride last year, his full-time ride, so he's running Indy only. Hopefully there'll be another couple events that he'll get to run. And I'm excited for him. I'm excited for Dreyer Reinbolt because this young man really knows how to drive the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So he's actually got a chance, if he has decent equipment, to maybe make a run at winning the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indianapolis 500. Well, from the pages of The Drive, some weird and unusual automotive news. The headline reads, "Finally, a sweet casket I can drive." If you wish every day was Halloween, well, here's your ride. We live in an era where cars can accelerate ridiculously fast, reach outrageous top speeds, and even jump in the air. But what we're lacking nowadays is some kind of creative builds that used to see, oh, decades ago. You know, the wild custom stuff from the Rat Fink posters. We're too busy talking about the newest EV or the beefiest pickup truck to hit the market. What would we be talking about with a sweet casket on wheels? That would surely outshine the Porsche owner. Oh, and that also expensive PTS color at your local car meet. Now, if you're currently going under the hammer to bring a trailer, this dragster-style custom casket is a one-of-a-kind ride that a 10-year-old would have loved to have, especially on Halloween night. Just imagine how popular you would have been cruising around the neighborhood yelling, "Trick or treat," and this bad boy. Now, according to the description, building this thing was an entire project, and an expensive one, too. It's worth noting that funky builds are typically half-based just for the wow factor, and it appears this one has been meticulously developed and executed. Well, the 8-foot long fiberglass casket is attached to a custom box frame chassis, which extends several feet to support the front wheels, and a transverse leaf spring for suspension. The Ford rear end axle is shoved across the casket right under the driver's knees and painted with the car's spooky motif. Comfortably? No. Conversation starter? You betcha. Now, driving this deathly contraption is a Chevrolet small block V8 of unknown performance specs. It breathes through a Holley 4-barrel carburetor and an Edelbrock intake manifold. It's paired with a 3-speed turbohydromatic 350 automatic transmission. It slows down courtesy of Wilwood rotors up front and drums in the back. Keeping you on the road, hopefully, are the 15-inch wheels all the way around. The front ones are 165 with wide track radials, with the rear's massive 3213 Hoosier slicks. Now, you might have guessed this, but this creation was inspired by something out of Hollywood, specifically the Dragula coffin car that was originally shown on the TV show The Munsters back in 1965. This isn't a replica per se, but the original builder got the main idea from the show. Now, whether or not you want to feel like a TV star, and a creepy one at that, or just want to have the silliest car on the block, you can part ways with at least $11,500. Well, you might be able to get this. However, the auction still has days left, so that price could increase quite a bit. Yeah, if you're looking for something fun and funky, how about a car that's shaped like a casket? Well, the headline reads, "Cruise Robo Taxis Road to Redemption will start in Phoenix." The General Motors self-driving unit will begin human-driven mapping in Arizona this week ahead of an eventual relaunch. Now, if you haven't heard enough good news on, or any good news, on General Motors' self-driving Cruise unit lately, well, there's a good reason. The company was alleged by the California Department of Vehicles to have withheld footage concerning an October hit and run of one of the firm's vehicles it was involved in. Cruise promptly suspended operations across the country, recalled nearly 1,000 robo-taxis in its fleet, and the Cruise path back to offering fare has become unclear in recent months. But now it seems the company is going to resume activity in Phoenix, Arizona. First testing may begin as early as this week. Now, according to a spokesperson, Pat Morrissey confirmed this plan to Bloomberg on Tuesday, and it's important that the testing isn't code for a beta run on autonomous rides with the public or anything of that nature. Crews personnel will be driving the fleet on the streets of Phoenix to create maps and gather road information, in the company's own words. This work is done using human-driven vehicles with autonomous systems engaged, and it's a critical step in validating our self-driving processes as we work toward returning to our driverless mission. Now, this effort will begin in Phoenix, but it will need to happen in far more cities so Cruise can return to some kind of operational scale before it hit the tragedy last fall. Back then, the Cruise was up and running in San Francisco, where a hit-and-run accident occurred. Houston, Austin, Dallas, Texas, Miami, Florida, and Phoenix. Now speaking to officials in 20 metropolitan areas, according to Bloomberg. Although Phoenix was reportedly favored as a starting point because it already has had cars there, and the city was receptive to Cruise's and General Motors' request. Now, after this first mapping is done, the Cruise robo-taxis will begin supervised driving with human driver in the car to ensure everything is running properly. So it figures for maybe a while before Cruise starts bringing in any money, which may be a problem because Cruise lost General Motors nearly $3.5 billion last year. Nevertheless, General Manager and CEO Mary Barra said in January that the company is committed to the self-driving startup. So we'll see. It was a problem in San Francisco. Well, hopefully it's not a problem here in Phoenix, as the Cruise division of General Motors is going to be operating here in our metro area. Well, the headline reads, the Tesla Cybertruck deliveries are being held because the pedals are falling apart. Well, TikTok user El Chapo posted a video explaining what happened to their Cybertruck, clarifying the delays that other owners have posted on the Cybertruck forums and Reddit. The issue stems not from the pedal exactly, but the aluminum plate cover, which slides up and down while driving and wedges itself between the pedal and the plastic bulkhead. When this happens, the cover pins of the throttle are nearly flat, even if you lift your foot off the pedal. Holding the brake pedal down fully will override the throttle operation and allow the truck to stop, but once you let off the brake, it's back to full throttle, so some drivers are having to actually shut their trucks down to get them stopped. Now, at that point, you can remove the pedal cover and everything is back to normal, but even one sudden unexpected burst of wide-open throttle in a vehicle that has 845 horsepower and weighs up to 6,600 pounds can be disastrous, especially if the driver panics. So to remedy this issue, Tesla has been putting a stop on the sales of the Cybertruck, according to a post on X from a Tesla influencer. Tesla has stopped all Cybertruck deliveries for 7 days due to an issue with the accelerator pedal, he reported. Now, there's no wording on how many Cybertrucks have already been on the road with faulty pedal covers. Owners also might want to preemptively remove theirs to be safe. Of course, customers can bring their truck into the local Tesla service center and have the pedal checked and or fixed. The pedal, if Cybertruck pedal covers are really merely snapped out of place at the factory, some adhesive fasteners would do the trick. Nevertheless, owners have reported they have reportedly gone without their trucks while getting them repaired, and one said that they offered only an Uber credit to get home from the service center. Well, I tell you, folks, a lot of people love Tesla, but I'm hearing some not-so-great reports, and especially about the Cybertruck. How about this for some unusual automotive news? Atlanta magnet man trawls nails off the streets with his bike and his trailer. Well, Alex has been going around Atlanta, Georgia with an admirable mission of removing dangerous refuge like screws and nails from thoroughfares and keeping them out of people's cars and trucks' tires. Now, we discovered this on Instagram, where he's built a bit of a following and keeping genuinely appreciative fan base for his noble pursuits of recreational street cleaning. He's also put some serious creative energy into homebrewed trash collection technology. He also come with his enterprise on the Clover Club podcast. So I put a trailer behind my bicycle, and I put magnets on the bottom, and I use it to pick up nails and screws so our tires won't have to pick up these pieces of metal. Well, if you go to Instagram, you can find out that he's quite popular. Now, this guy comes across very conscientious and creative, and it makes a lot of sense that a person would build a cool contraption like the magnet road cleaning bike trailer. For this project itself, it seems like a larger trailer might be hard to imagine. A bicycle towing much bigger has strips of magnets and that pull metallic objects off the pavement into its visible clutches. There's neodymium magnets, which I've learned are the stronger kinds of permanent magnets commercially available, and a wide push broom helps to catch the errant flotsam from getting to the magnets. So just imagine somebody driving a bicycle around town, dragging a magnet contraption on a little trailer and help sucking up all the crud and metal off the road to help keep our tires nice and clean and free from flats. Well, it's that time. It's time for a little car talk. Just read a recent column you had in Answer to David about how to tow vehicles with automatic transmissions. And made me think about my parents' RV trips years ago where they towed a 1995 Jeep Cherokee with an automatic transmission behind their RV. The transfer case was in neutral while being towed, and I don't remember about the transmission itself. Was that acceptable, or was that causing major wear and damage to the drivetrain? Thank you. And that's from Stuart. Well, since they got away with it, I'm going to conclude it wasn't that bad, Stuart. After all, you didn't describe it as the 1995 Jeep Cherokee that went through three automatic transmissions. Now, those Jeep Cherokees in those days had an old-style four-wheel drive system, which means it did not have a center differential. Modern all-wheel drive vehicles have a center differential, with four wheels connected to the powertrain at all times. Those vehicles, we'd recommend using a flatbed to tow. But on the old Cherokees, by putting the transfer case in neutral, you could literally disconnect the front drive shaft and the front wheels from the rest of the drivetrain. That way, the front wheels could turn freely without being connected to the transmission itself. So if your folks put the transfer case in neutral and lifted the rear wheels of the Cherokee off the ground and towed it facing backwards on its wheels, well, it would have been perfectly safe. Now, if they towed it with all four wheels on the ground, well, that's a different story. It wouldn't necessarily ruin the transmission, but it would cause the transmission to, heat up. The transmission only gets cooled when the engine is running. So towing it, especially at highway speeds for hours at a time, potentially could shorten the transmission's life. How do you know for sure? Well, you could track down the person who your parents sold the car to. I definitely would conceal your number when you call, just in case they're a little steamed about the fact they had to buy another transmission right after purchasing the Jeep. That's a good question. I've had some family members that were big RV fans, and they towed Honda, like a Honda Civic and a Honda Accord. So I'm not sure if they had to disconnect the drive shaft or what the situation was, but they made it work. Well, that's all the time we have for the car show today, folks. My name's Jeff Wine. We'll meet you back on the radio again next Sunday, and you're listening to Sun Sounds Radio of Arizona.